Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. I'm your host, Rob Anderson, and on this podcast, we seek out the world's best researchers, coaches, support staff, teachers, and athletes to better understand the process of long-term athlete development. Don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform and 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50. That's LTADVIP50 at the LTAD Network Hub website. This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets, just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Sam Boylett-Long. Sam has been an accredited S&C coach with the UKSCA since 2012. Since completing his Masters in Human Performance in 2015, Sam has worked with a number of women's football internationals during his 4-year spell with Reading Women. In January 2020, Sam began working with the GB rowing team, providing S&C and sports science support, leading various projects including warm-up strategies, maximizing physical readiness, and developing objective diagnostics for FMAX assessment.
Sam, welcome to the podcast. Awesome to have you on this blistering hot afternoon in the UK.
Nah, thanks, Rob. Glad to be here. Just about got some aircon on, so managed to stay reasonably cool.
Yeah. For those who obviously don't know either of us, we've obviously known each other from the past at St Mary's. She's produced an awful lot of S&C coaches over the years, but you've gone on to bigger and better things than that. So before we dive into your work in rowing, tell us a bit about your own background growing up. What sports did you play? Were you a good athlete, a terrible athlete, just a hopeful athlete? Tell us a bit about yourself.
I'd describe myself as an eternal optimist in many walks of life, but certainly wouldn't say I was a great athlete growing up, but certainly threw a lot of energy onto the rugby pitch was probably where I spent most of my time. Certainly as a teenager, and then that passion sort of grew. A couple of stints with Sussex at a county level was probably the sort of peak of my sporting career at county level. Made a debut for my local club, Worthing, most notably with their fifth team, the Irregulars, Worthing Irregulars. So I didn't quite make it past the fifth string team, but I'll probably leave that one there. From there, as a teenager, I sustained a pretty substantial hip injury from a skiing accident, which I'd recovered from, thankfully. And then I sort of found my next passion, which was cycling, which then probably wasn't a great precursor to my next passion, which was, as you well know, becoming a founding member of the Simmies or St. Mary's University weightlifting and powerlifting club. So going from cycling to weightlifting and then back again, actually in the summer, that was a pretty tough turnaround going back to my cycling club as a teenager and a couple of kilos heavier. I mean, power output was pretty good, but there was a couple of instances of me with cramp side of the road and trying to chug some electrolytes. So I wouldn't recommend that. Weightlifting, powerlifting, certainly for the 3 years during my undergrad at St. Mary's, then became my passion. And then since then, managed to fall back into cycling, specifically track cycling, actually, And then, yeah, a couple of years on from there, I'm now training for a trail marathon. So, and everything in between, really. So I just enjoy, you know, getting out, enjoying the outside. So yeah, still fancy myself as a bit of a lifter. Certainly not at my Simi's day lifting currently. Don't ask me what my Sinclair is at the moment, but yeah, it's not great. Yeah, anything I can do to get outside at the moment, to be honest, mate.
So when was it that SNC coaching kind of came in as a potential avenue for you? What was it that piqued your interest, or how did you find out about strength conditioning and think, might go down that route?
Yeah, it was probably back at college. I mean, even growing up, you know, I suppose you could say I got indoctrinated into gym life fairly early in year seven at secondary school. Had a number of friends that sort of, you know, were trying out for rugby and football and were interested in the gym, and, you know, I kind of got roped into it and actually quite enjoyed the environment and what it, you know, meant in terms of having a goal that you're working towards. And then, yeah, fast forward, college, did a BTEC, diploma in sport, essentially. As again, I was just that way inclined. I didn't really, you know, I wasn't really an academic. Still wouldn't really say I'm an academic now, but that then opened up a lot of doors, looking into sort of vocational programs. And then again, played for Worthing College, who at the time were notorious in the rugby scene, along with Worthing Rugby Club. And, you know, massive area of rugby performance is, you know, gym based, as we know, land based training and training that physicality. And I think that sort of just sparked my interest. My supervisor at college found the St. Mary's University SNC undergrad and suggested I'd apply for it. Applied and thankfully got on to that. And that's all she wrote, really. I think, you know, as I'm sure we'll get onto, there's a number of internships that, you know, but that just continued to breed this passion and excitement for all things S&C and sports science related. But yeah, it was probably starting off at a secondary school or college level that, you know, S&C found me, and, you know, I just grabbed it with both hands, really, and ran with it.
So let's dig into those kind of stops along the way. So you mentioned internships. So where were your internships, and how did that post uni start to produce work opportunities, and where did that take you?
Yeah, so straight after St. Mary's, like most people, come out of a sports science or S&C degree, and I thought, sweet, got the bit of paper. Now let's go do the stuff, and hopefully, you know, some form of ikigai. You know, I can find a well-paid job, and, you know, it's essentially a hobby. But, you know, you get those Venn diagrams dissecting, and yeah, that's S&C. I love what I do, and I'm going to find a job and get paid for it. Well, number of years passed of me falling in and out of various internships and various building and labouring contractors. Worked on farms, personal trained. Probably for 2 or 3 years before, you know, I got any real traction. But straight after uni, my first internship was under Matt Springham at Brighton and Hove back in would have been 2013. So yeah, that was back when they were in the championship, and were pretty competitive in and out over the next couple of years before they then managed to make the leap into the Prem. But, you know, under Matt, who's now a lecturer at St. Mary's Uni, it was under Matt that, I suppose, load monitoring, GPS, sports science, you know, endocrine analytics, all those sorts of things, you know, a lot of those things were quite new to me. Certainly those falling within like saliva sampling and those sorts of things. And that's, you know, I think that really sparked my interest from that sports science, that raw sports science background that I had through St. Mary's, because obviously it was an S&C degree, not a sports science degree. But there was a lot of practical elements that, you know, really were interesting to me at the time. And certainly the GPS side of things and load monitoring, you know, that expertise that I learned under Matt, I really, really sort of took that on board, and that really actually came back to pay dividends a couple of years later when I was with Reading Women's Football, but I'll come on to that in a sec. But unfortunately, like these things roll out in football, got to the end of the season, you know, try and line up a job. Yep, I think we've got something, got some real traction. There's definitely, you know, a role for you here. And then unfortunately for me, Matt left Brighton in the off season and went on to pastures new. And then so I went back to almost back to square one. You know, I had some good networks, starting to build those. Couple of months, years later, again, personal training and working on various farms. I then managed to stumble into actually what was one of the best experiences of my life from a professional and personal development perspective was working up in Stirling in Scotland. So under Neil Donald and David Leith specifically. So there, again, I've kind of gone from sports science and we've you know, diving back into S&C and, you know, those two. So Neil's now the head of S&C, I think, at the SIS, and Dave's now moved into more of a hops-based role. But I still try to keep in touch. But worked with a number of athletes across triathlon, swimming, netball, curling even. So a number of the guys that went to the Glasgow Games 2014, I think, but yeah, so the curlers to the Winter Olympics. Yeah, that was an unbelievable opportunity. At the time, I was actually given a scenario where I had to choose between an internship with West Ham's Academy or an internship with the guys up in Stirling. And, you know, it took me about half hour to make that decision, having had the phone call from Neil saying we want you to come and intern with us. Granted, the West Ham internship was only going to be a year long, and then the internship up in Stirling ended up being, I think, 5 months. So, you know, difference in time, but in terms of the quality of learning under those guys was just immense. Certainly, like all you know, all things programming and periodization based. Yeah, they you know, just a number of really excellent practitioners up there in their network. But again, unfortunately, I wasn't able to secure a job at the end of that. You know, from an institute perspective, they just didn't have the funding, which, you know, absolutely fine. But, you know, rewind back to the relationships I built with Matt Springham. I actually was, I think I was actually back on one of the farms I'd worked previously, got a phone call from Matt, a couple of months, having finished at Scotland. And Stirling, and he said, got an opportunity that I think, you know, be absolutely perfect for you. It's a funded master's. And I was thinking, oh, just not really that interested in, you know, academia. It's all about the coaching for me and being face to face, you know, the coal face with the athletes. He said, no, look, you know, it'll be structured that you'll have the funded MSc. You can choose where you want to do it. And I ended up doing it at Brunel. Varsity rivals to St. Mary's, those who don't know. So a bit of a Judas on that, I'm afraid. But at the time, I didn't see the benefit of me going back to St. Mary's or doing an S&C degree, because I feel like I'd actually built a fair bit of knowledge in that area, having worked under Neil and David in Scotland. So I thought, actually, let's zoom this back out. Let's go into sports science. So I ended up doing an MSc in human performance at Brunel whilst working pretty much every other hour and day under the sun with the Brentford first team. So back into football, so back into the Championship. And then evenings were spent either doing reading, research for the masters, or actually coaching age group. So had this real nice balance between operating at a senior level, looking at, you know, what that provision to elite sport looks like in football, but then also having that real appreciation actually of S&C within a junior pathway within football. And again, that was back when Brentford had a, you know, really substantial pathway and progression model. And now, obviously, as you'll know, they just have a under 23s development program, unfortunately. And again, got to the end of the season, and yeah, it was between myself and one of my friends who I'm still close with now, who got the sports science full-time gig with the first team. And it's one of those where he was a specialist in that area of sports science and load management. I'd merely dabbled under Matt, you know, at Brighton and still learning. Whereas, you know, my true bread and butter really was S&C. So yeah, end of the season finishes, and then again go my merry way with my second bit of paper, second qualification. And then, yeah, again, it wasn't until 2016. So this was 2 years, I think, after finishing my master's, year or two, where I actually got my first paid gig. So, you know, from 2012 to what's this, 2016. Yeah. So, you know, a good 3-4 years of internships and trying to, you know, hold a living, to pay for these unpaid placements. Finally got my first paid gig with Reading Women, who had just been newly promoted into the Women's Super League from what is now the Women's Championship. And for me, that really was, you know, a hell of an experience for a number of reasons. But I think the first one that I'm often, or at the time I was definitely, you know, not thankful enough for, was the fact that because they were newly promoted, and the FA still has this structure in place where I think teams in the Women's Super League or Championship, you know, have a allocated pot of money for S&C coaches. And certainly now this is pertinent because of the ACL crisis, if you want to call it that, that women's football is seeing. You know, it's more evident that we need S&C and sports science practitioners at those clubs. But so I was thankful for that. But it was more that the manager and the first team coach never had worked with an S&C coach or sports scientist before. So when I entered in that role, it was very much a carte blanche of, well, Sam's the S&C and sports science guy. So whatever you want to do, you know, you can deliver that. And, you know, we'll have full faith in what you want to deliver as a sports science and S&C strategy. So it was there, I guess, that, you know, I really ground my teeth in, you know, getting stuck into it. And I was really, you know, first time accountable for everything. You know, we're talking all of the inferences from GPS, what I think the week should, you know, look like from a structure perspective, the land-based training, robustness strategies, and then even actually my first experience of line managing. So we also had a number of S&Cs within the development and pathway space. So going from an intern to that was a hell of a jump. But yeah, one of the best jumps, you know, personally and professionally. And then I suppose was with Reading Women up until December 2019, and then managed to get a little bit of time off over Christmas holidays, and then started with rowing, Jan 2020, just pre-COVID crisis hitting. So that was a hell of an experience in itself, really, that initial 4 weeks. The crazy thing with starting was the now chief coach of the men's side. He was due to go on this camp to Namibia. And, you know, if you gave me an atlas and told me our training camp for the men's rowing team is going to Namibia, I wouldn't have been able to point to Namibia on a map. Just, you know, I'd heard that they'd maybe had a rugby team based on playing Jonah Lomu rugby, you know, 2003 on the PlayStation or something. But to actually think that, you know, Olympic programs go to these places to train, I didn't even think about it. But with the Institute, you know, there's a fair bit of processes around HR and recruitment, as you'll well know. And I got told that my first 2 weeks was basically be doing back-to-back modules, meeting various key stakeholders. And basically I had 48 hours notice that I needed to check my passport was in date because the now chief coach had gone ill. And I was basically booked onto a flight to Namibia. So, I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better start, to be honest, to this new role than new role at the time, because, you know, I would have been a couple of thousand miles away from these athletes whom, you know, I'd be talking to via WhatsApp. And, you know, whereas what actually happened was, you know, ridiculously fast turnaround to me running around Reading Town Centre, making sure I've got, you know, Mozzie spray and all that sort of stuff to a continent I've never visited. and working with some incredible practitioners and athletes, but I wouldn't have changed it for anything, to be honest. It just meant I was staying up late doing these management and risk assessment modules whilst worrying about programming. But I wouldn't have changed it, and actually enabled me more contact time with the coaches, more contact time with the athletes, and also the support staff, never met before. And it was really, really ramped up the learning opportunities. And most importantly, those relationships you build with the coaches, and drinking a beer or a wine with Jürgen Grobler, of an evening, and trying to build that relationship and that rapport incredibly quickly. So appreciate that was me waffling for a good 5-10, mate. But very much a whistle stop tour of going from I'd hardly say a rags to riches story, but certainly going from intern to hopefully a reasonable practitioner in an Olympic program.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a whistle stop tour. So tell us a bit about that initial job. Where in the pathway were you working? Were you at the elite end? Were you in the pathway? What were the numbers of athletes and the kind of level of experience you were working with? Paint us a bit of a picture of what sort of the context was for that.
Back at Reading, that first paid gig.
No, in terms of that first role within the rowing setup.
Okay. Yeah, so same role as I'm doing now, really, is just leading the S&C provision for the men predominantly. And, the crossover between programs is, mainly to cover, or historically, the men used to train at Bisham Abbey National Sports Centre, which is still essentially, the crown jewel, if you like, of the Institute's, locations. Now, because of COVID, the men have essentially got used to a certain way of operating. So we're now based actually at the National Training Centre, which is Caversham, close to Reading. Rewind back when we were at Bisham, we'd have 30 athletes in the gym at a time. So we'd roughly have 30 men all lifting at the same time. Anyone who's been to Bisham, it's incredibly well laid out. You've got platforms, racks, plates, capacity of that gym is probably closer to 60, 70 athletes. So 30, in there. I mean, they fill the space, rowers, because they are ginormous, two and a half meters, some of them, 100 to 115 kilos on the men's side. They fill the space and fill the cages. That was actually probably the biggest transition, was sort of like, working with female footballers who were probably, my height, if not a little bit taller, compared to working with, these ginormous, physical animals. So that was probably the biggest change. But typically, we'd have 30 athletes in the gym. Most weight sessions would be anywhere between 75 minutes and 2 hours, depending on the content we've got to get through. And that'll include warm up and, the robustness, preparation, a briefing. So most sessions will start with me shouting at the lads and pointing at a telly with the program on it, and what we're getting after and why. And then that's typically preceded by the first S&C session of a new block. And this is something that's done across men's, women's, and the Paralympic program, is just setting the tone of what each block of training is going to look like. And if there's any testing, and what the sort of outcomes are from each block of training, probably more pertinent for your camp blocks of training. But in terms of numbers, 30 is probably the limit. Unless we've got phases of work where we'll have development athletes coming in, and that number could creep closer to 40, but in rare cases, it's probably more in the development scene where, just because of the way that the Olympic program runs, we can have anywhere between 40 and 80 athletes in the Bisham gym at one time. So that's where myself and Ben Sheath, the women's S&C, will look to support Alice, who's our S&C for the 23s program. We'll look to support her, just because coach to athlete ratio can end up being quite poor. I mean, for myself at Caversham, I'm quite fortunate with the men that we actually split the group in half. So you know, in terms of S&C practitioner to athlete, it's probably about a 1 to 15, which I think for some guys, you'd probably say you'd want to try and, you know, increase that. So a high number of S&C coaches, but just because of the way that we're running or operating at the moment, it's just not feasible. Obviously, Ben working over at Bisham is about half an hour away from the National Training Centre. And as I said earlier, since COVID times, this split had just happened organically. And actually, you know, speaking with the chief coach, he actually prefers us to lift here, certainly in terms of like time management and that R&R between water session and weights. You know, the athletes have got much more time to relax and recoup energy before targeting the next session. You know, again, that was the second biggest change, was actually understanding what the human body can do from a physical output perspective. I've never seen anything like it before. That training camp in Namibia, you know, I was trying to get to every single session I could, you know, beyond the S&C the S&C room. And you know, you're looking at guys doing 3 sessions a day, 4 to 5 days a week. Some Sundays off, otherwise, you know, 2 sessions. So typically, you know, it'll be a 3 session day, Monday, Tuesday, 2 session day, Wednesday, 3 session Thursday, sometimes 2 sessions on a Friday, 2 on a Saturday, and then Sunday off, and then rinse and repeat through the season. It's pretty grueling. Given the nature of the sport, you know, the coaches will say it's a requirement. And then from a weights perspective, you're typically looking at a minimum of 3 to 4 weight sessions throughout, certainly like the winter block of training. So if we start in September, you know, we'll probably keep 3 to 4 weight sessions through until February, March time. And then that number can increase up to 8 weight sessions a week, which is the case when we enter our camp training blocks in Sierra Nevada, which, you know, I think that's a pretty good ski resort, but yeah, food not great, you know, it's an okay establishment, but yeah, there's some areas of high risk for us, certainly because the food isn't that good. So you couple 8 weights training sessions plus, you know, the physiological training sessions on top of that, you know, can cause a bit of concern, certainly in terms of mass loss across the group. But yeah, hopefully that paints a pretty broad brushstroke on the number of training sessions, what that looks like. You know, again, when I was sat in the back of an ergo room in Namibia, my first week on the job, you know, sat there and hopefully was able to hide the grimace under my mask, because I just never seen so much training done in such a short space of time as a 24-hour period. You know, to give you a very rough insight to what those 3 sessions looks like. You know, I've already said weights. If we say one of those 3 sessions is a weight session, you know, minimum of 75 to 90 minutes of solid traditional strength training. The other 2 sessions potentially looks like a 24K ergo. So 24K on a Concept 2 ergometer. And the other one potentially looks like a 16K ergo. So, you know, the guys will often look at a program, and if there's a 30K day planned, that's a bloody tough day at the office. And anyone who's hopped on an ergo would know that it's pretty, you know, grueling anyway. I actually got goaded into the last training camp we had at altitude Sierra Nevada. I got goaded into doing a 16K ergo. And, you know, I'd like to say actually, pretty you know, bold comment, but currently at British Rowing, I currently have the course record on the 16K ergo at altitude. This is, you know, predominantly within the S&C department. I don't know if any other support staff member has been stupid enough to try and hold 16K, try and get that down at altitude. But yeah, I suppose that's probably stemmed from my philosophy of trying stuff. I'm always interested to, you know, try and experience what the athlete's experiencing. So my time in Reading, you know, I'd continually be out on the pitch and playing around with, you know, agility-based drills or, you know, movement challenges to include in warm-ups, mainly so I can understand it. And then also, because, you know, no one wants to look silly demoing these things. I profess the rowing tech is not my forte, and there's definitely some footage of that which I can share afterwards, more for a laugh. But we're certainly a work in progress. I'll say that much.
Yeah, but again, well, you've hit on a few things there that I want to pick up on. So the first is, I don't know about you, but like I've experienced over the years, there's certain sports where you maybe get athletes that. You can get athletes that are a little bit lazy, maybe a lazy footballer or a lazy wing in rugby or whatever. And then there's sports like swimming and rowing, where if you're lazy, you're probably not getting out of bed at 4 in the morning. You're probably not going to go and sit in a boat. You're probably not going to row 20 kilometers. So the sport itself has a natural way of getting rid of those people.
Yeah.
And so there's just a huge culture of work, hard work, being out, you know, being able to suffer, for want of a better word. But what are some of the characteristics that make an elite level rower? We've already mentioned, obviously, anthropometrics. Me and you are probably at least a foot too small to be anything remotely useful in a rowing boat. So give us a bit of an overview. What are some of the kind of, I guess, the physical characteristics, height-wise, et cetera? What about the strength and power characteristics? What are we looking at in terms of what are the demands of elite level rowing?
Yeah, so I think you touched on it already, but in terms of like the raw, you know, anthropometrics, you're sort of talking like long or large wingspan relative to height. You know, certainly looking like Yemo Sabihi, one of the flag bearers at the Tokyo Games. You know, is probably a great example of what a typical rower would look like from a model perspective. And that's model in terms of the anthros, not necessarily in terms of the actual, you know, rig, just in case Mo is going to listen to this one. But jesting aside, you know, in terms of the underlying physiology, some of the KPIs that, you know, we'd often refer to would be power at 2 and 4 millimole of lactate. Which is often utilized as an assessment. You know, we're looking at like the bore shift to see if someone's actually moved on from a physiological perspective. So utilizing blood lactate. Otherwise, you know, obviously traditional measures like VO2 max, you know, as you say, long levers are obviously going to help. It's not to say that, you know, if you're sub 6 foot that you don't stand a chance, but obviously from a physics perspective, and work done, it's a little bit easier. But actually, what I'm finding out more and more from a technical perspective is rowing is not a simple sport to objectively quantify the technical demands. Hence why, if you were to do like a PubMed search, yes, there are a lot of papers on, you know, rough percentages of you know, distribution of work done on a 2K ergo assessment, but actually on the water is incredibly difficult. Certainly when you try and get the white lab coats out and you know, really trying to get rid of the noise, obviously because the environmental conditions, but even actually at a crew level, obviously those who don't know, within rowing, you have two separate disciplines. You have sculling and you have sweep rowing. Sweep with one oar, and then sculling is with two. So straight away, you know, if you have someone in a single scull, that's just one athlete. So you can, you know, quite cleanly, if you like, biomech the boats and the athlete up, and you've only got one athlete to worry about. As soon as you then have a sweep athlete, they need a partner. They need a pairs partner. So straight away, you have this noise of actually, if this athlete, you know, if we're in a crew together and you're sort of, you know, leaning one way, and you're disturbing the boat in one element, I'm then going to have to try and counteract that. So straight away, there's one area of noise. So in terms of like the, you know, degrees of freedom within rowing is vast, is ginormous. There's a lot of, you know, in-house work that we're doing as well at the moment with performance innovation to try and better understand the technical demands of the skill. Again, you know, it's not just the 16K ergo that I've done. During the Tokyo cycle, so 2021, the Tokyo Games, whilst the guys were out there, I was fortunate enough to jump into a double sculls with one of the guys that was still doing some work here. And notoriously difficult actually to try and balance a boat, especially, you know, certainly some of your smaller boats where actually, you know, your bum is almost overhanging overhanging the boat. So in terms of balancing, you know, what is an incredibly light piece of kit, incredibly difficult. And when you watch it on the telly, they make it look effortless in terms of that balancing. It almost looks like, you know, anyone can just jump in and move a, you know, move a boat and just move forwards and up, up and down the slide. There's just so much more nuance to it. And a lot of the coaches all, you know, use this term, Rob's a great boat mover. And when I first heard that term, I was like, oh, they're all boat movers. They're all doing the thing. Doesn't really make sense to me, you know? And actually you spend a lot of time, and I've spent hours and hours up and down the towpath, listening to how all the coaches coach and trying to ask good questions, what I think are good questions around the coaches' cues that they are giving, what they're seeing and what, you know, they're interpreting, and then giving back to the athlete in terms of feedback. But objectively, there's still not an awful lot from a technical efficiency perspective that we're able to currently hang our hat on. So give you an example of like cycling, you know, a lot of certainly like the velodrome-based cycling and track cycling, using crank-based power meters, straight away you can look at asymmetries, you can look at you're collecting data every single training session on these athletes, not just internal external training loads, but you're looking specifically from a biomech perspective at like how quickly they're putting the power down, what's that look like, what degree was the peak force or peak power that they're producing, and then you can extrapolate from that, you know, your KPIs and what's important, what isn't. And, you know, that's an area that I've started to delve into more so from an S&C purist's perspective in, you know, what are the underlying forces that are required? And then can we actually work back to what are some land-based diagnostics that we're able to use? And then try and dovetail that with our performance innovation and actually what is it that they're seeing on the water from a, you know, what denotes performance on the water instead of going the halfway house is a 2K ergo, because I don't think the 2K ergo is a particularly good halfway house, because from what we know, you know, from an injury perspective and front loading the stroke on an ergo compared to the water, injury rates are higher on an ergo compared to the water, just from a compressive perspective on the spine. And just like the boat feel, athletes will often talk to me in the gym about, oh, well, actually this exercise feels more like what we experience on the water compared to this exercise. And you're going, okay, that's really interesting from a dynamic correspondence perspective, you know, try and pick that apart. Is there something in the specificity of the task? Well, you know, there's some more research on that in terms of, you know, actually the more relatable the task is to the outcome, then there's potentially going to be a high degree of transfer when we're talking about that transfer from land-based training to try and improve the sport. So there's definitely some merit in looking at that. And there's hundreds of questions I've got, you know, all the time for other disciplines with if a coach calls you a boat mover, that's probably like one of the best compliments you'd be able to get given. But from a raw physiological perspective, yeah, there's no shying away about, you know, 2 and 4 minimal power out those numbers. And then, yeah, the lever arm.
So one of the other things that it would be remiss of me not to ask if we're looking at this is we talked a little bit about work ethic and then, you know, it's probably a little bit different. Every sport's a little bit different in terms of, you know, what's required. Obviously, rowing, they love an early morning session on the river. But also, as you alluded to, these guys are big human beings. Like, they're tall. They've got massive levers. They're also doing an incredible amount of work in the boat, in the gym. You also talked about the importance of maintaining muscle mass. So from a performance lifestyle perspective, obviously, you know, sleep plays a big part of it. But let's dig in a little bit into the nutrition side of things. I mean, how many calories are these guys going to have to consume a day to just fuel their bodies? Because they are big units, big engines.
Yeah, depending on it's ginormous amount, to be honest with you. Most training days, somewhere between 5 and 7, 7,500, depending on the volume of training. you know, it's a vast quantity. And you know, there are two things actually I'll probably big up whilst I'm on. The first one is our chef, who does an incredible job, and you know, is able, and we or the NGB is able to subsidize a lot of the cost for the athletes, which is good. We're not at a level where, you know, like football, for example, you know, most football clubs will just prepare every single meal of the day for the athletes. You know, the resources we've got are finite, but you know, the food that Martin the chef puts on is incredible. And then the second area, you know, you touched on around like the performance lifestyle. And one thing, you know, I think we do incredibly well as a sport is what we call the Friday forums. So throughout the calendar year, Gaz, who's our you know, who's a sports science lead, will take up opportunities to either pull in like practitioners from outside the sport that he has within the network. So a recent one was Dr. Luke Gunther, who was probably widely known as the sleep guru, who came in to do a talk on sleep hygiene, and all those and everything comes under that. We've had other ones, you know, which have been directed specifically to like, you know, race strategies, for example. So like this weekend, the guys were in Varese racing. And it was more like, you know, the nutritionist has traveled to get a better understanding of what, you know, the demands are throughout the day. You know, another Gareth or Gaz, who's been with us for a couple of months, but the sport has always had a nutritionist, whether that's part-time or full-time. And you know, we've got a fairly substantial library of, you know, resources for the athletes as well, which they can access at any time. And that would be, you know, examples of, you know, hypertrophy based training, what that looks like working with myself or, you know, another S&C practitioner and the underlying energy cost of that. There'll be other ones for, you know, lightweight rowers who need to make weight, and there'll be strategies on how to do that or how best to do that. So yeah, I think from a performance lifestyle perspective, when it concerns like the training program and, you know, those sorts of things, I think is fairly well covered. I'd say it's fairly well covered from an education side of things, but in terms of actually, if we were to, you know, hypothetical survey the athletes, I think there'd be a number of them which would be fairly stringent on, you know, sleep times, what, you know, their strategy is for winding down in the evenings, whether that's, you know, an ergogenic or you know, what their diet looks like in rolling into that sleep to, you know, try and bring about that sleep inertia, and then recovery, what that looks like, you know, going into their sleep. But then even their nutritional strategy throughout, you know, warm-ups and race day and things like that, I think is fairly well, you know, structured, I think, from if it's not for myself, it would be from, you know, the nutritionist or the chef or even like sports psych, so even having like psychological interventions in place to aid aid sleep is something that we're trying to shout about a little bit more to the athletes. So yeah, I think it's, you know, and as you said earlier around like the type of athlete, yeah, it's no surprise that a sport like rowing or swimming probably, you know, has a fair bit of athlete turnover, and it's, you know, it's because the programs that you know, these bigger programs that are physiologically based, you know, it's a huge volume of training that they're undertaking, and you know, that does and will take a toll, I think, psychologically. And I think, you know, the athletes that utilize the sport science MDT or resources are those that probably hang around like a little bit longer. You know, that doesn't have to be sports psych or performance lifestyle. I think it's also, you know, keeping themselves healthy. So in rowing, it's no surprise that we get a ton of hips and backs are probably our two biggest time loss injuries, or, you know, LBP. So the guys that, you know, stay on program the longest are probably those that have, you know, spent a lot of time with myself or the physios on making sure they're doing their prep for sessions, you know, there's a handful that will, like most, be lucky and just get the program done and not do too much, you know, outside of those training sessions. But you know, I sort of see my primary role as a risk mitigator, you know, and I want to keep athletes in the boat. And that was always my primary role when I was at Reading, is, you know, I love to watch sport and love watching the women, you know, go out on the pitch, you know, every game, much to how I enjoy watching the guys on the telly and when I can in person at regattas, you know, because I want to watch them tear it up and be the best version of themselves. So that's why I sort of think my primary role as an S&C coach and my philosophy is to try and help keep them in the boat, whether it's training or competition, you know, or keeping players on the pitch. And then the second is the performance strand, because hopefully if you keep people in, you know, the sport from a technical perspective, you know, hopefully they're improving at a higher rate because they're completing more training, not just from a physiological perspective, but from a technical demands perspective. And then also from my perspective as an S&C in performance, it's incredibly difficult to go, you know, off the start line, they're producing X amount of torque around the knee extensors or around the knee joint. So then, you know, we need to extrapolate from that. We're not just there yet. It's not as close as like a, you know, a track start in track cycling is for you know, for a Kieran or whatever discipline, way easier in that sport to extrapolate from the task. But yeah, certainly watch this space, because I'd hope to help that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the performance lifestyle is massive. I think, you know, I guess for reference for those people listening, like if you imagine, you know, if you've ever had a hungry teenage boy and the fridge is like a revolving door, in my experience, most teenage boys are probably eating about 3,000 calories a day. So if you take that and double it, that's pretty difficult to consume in a way that's actually got some nutritional value. You know, people might look at that and say, oh, fantastic, I'll get a couple of Dominoes in. That's probably not going to fuel you sufficiently to get through 16 kilometers on an erg. So, you know, that is it's a logistical problem, really, isn't it? Mm. To be able to consume that many calories in a way that's actually going to nourish your body. But also, it's just a big undertaking to eat that much. So I can see why, you know, rowing's one of the sports that probably has nutrition support a lot earlier on than maybe some of the other ones, because it's just, yeah, you know, that is a whole other separate training mode, being able to eat that much in a way that's useful.
that's very true. Very, very true. Lots of overnight oats and lots of porridge, lots of bircher muesli type stuff, certainly first session. But yeah, it's definitely a big undertaking that. Yeah, definitely a few athletes on the men's side struggle, I think, to, you know, get it, just as you say, get the sheer volume, you know, in.
I can only imagine. I mean, having worked in rugby and been helping guys get up to, you know, 90, 100, 110 kilos, you know, that's pretty tricky. But I think they're not doing anywhere near the same training volume. So I can only imagine that's a really, really tough task. I want to be respectful of your time, Sam. So what's next for you in the next 12 to 18 months? Obviously, the Olympic Games isn't a million miles away. What else is kind of at the forefront of your vision?
Yeah, so certainly, I suppose, acutely, you know, we've got a number of competitions up until World Champs in September. And then, you know, a bit of downtime. And then, yeah, so for those that don't know, a lot of, I suppose, a lot of different sports will have qualification events throughout the year. Rowing, like a number of other Olympic sports, it'll be at the World Champs. So there'll be a number of spots available for the next year's Olympics, based on where you ranked essentially at World Championships. So, you know, there's a lot of energy going into that. So a lot of my work over the last 6 months has actually been, well, say 6 months, probably the last 12 to 18 months has actually been around warm-ups, which, you know, sounds incredibly simple, but looking at optimized, like the endocrine responses throughout the day, so that, you know, guys are able to maximize their performance on the water. So there's a ton around that, which is kind of ongoing. And I see that as, you know, trying to push through to Paris and really impact some competitions along the way. And then, yeah, the other big project I'm working on through to Paris at the moment is a lot of work in our performance diagnostics. Yeah, there's a bit of work to do there, but certainly from a from a S&C within rowing perspective, you know, historically the sport's always utilized key lifts. So, you know, back squat, front squat, deadlift, bench press, bench pull, and your power clean. And we've historically as a sport just taken those as gospel from a FMAX perspective, if you like, of a proxy measure. So yeah, my thinking in the medium to long term has been to try and establish some better objective diagnostics to use. So I'm currently playing around with an isometric leg press variation and potential to bring in some ISO-K assessments for knee extension and flexion. So those are probably like the two biggest areas that I'm looking to impact pre-Paris. Yeah, so watch this space, really. I think, I'll hopefully pull my finger out and start getting some good data sets on that across the men's squad. You know, and it's worth saying that the robustness strategy is something that, you know, I see is a constant. And by that, that's, you know, when I referenced earlier, like our hips and backs, you know, it's more keeping guys healthy in the boat. So that's the overarching robustness strategy. So it's making sure we've got our tissue conditioning in place around the hip and trunk. And then also like we're able to transfer force effectively through the kinetic chains.
Fantastic. Well, where can people follow along if you, you know, where can I hunt you down on social media or LinkedIn? Where's the best place to see what you're up to?
You know what? I don't actually throw too much out there, but I'm on Twitter and Instagram. Probably more stuff going on the Instagram. Although I will profess, I need to start pushing some more stuff out there. Hopefully find some stuff that's worth following or watching. But yeah, Instagram's probably the one to find me. If anyone's got any. Yeah, specific rowing questions or S&C, you know, I'm always happy to chew the fat and grab a coffee or a beer and talk things, all things sports science and S&C, really. So yeah, those two. I wouldn't be able to tell you what my handles are. I'm not that au fait with my socials, but I'm sure if you throw Sam Boylett Long into into Twitter or Insta, you find me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we dig those out and I'll stick those in the show notes for people who want to follow along. Well, thanks so much, mate. It's been a real pleasure to catch up and great to see what you're up to at the UK Sport Institute with the rowing program and to get your thoughts on all things rowing. So thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Nah, thanks, Rob. As always, good to talk shop.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love your support by leaving a rating or review on your chosen podcast player. You can also find us on social media using @LTAD Network. Thanks for listening to this episode. And don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform, as well as 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50.